9 minutes past midnight. Time for a rendezvous. The baby's right there. July 24th is the date in the world's greatest city. I'm Phil Menicky on 720 WGN. Joining us are Barb and Ted Wackels of the Eastland Disaster Historical Society. Here to talk about an important event in the history of Chicago that few people know about, even a lot from Chicago. The Eastland Disaster. Happened 106 years ago today. How did you guys get involved? Barb, let's start with you.
Well, the reason that we know about the Eastland disaster was not something that I learned in school, because at that time, we weren't learning that in school. I learned all about it from my grandmother when I was growing up. My grandmother and her family of four all survived the tragedy. She was just about to turn 13, and she was with her younger sister, who was 9, and they were with their mother, who was my great-grandmother, and my great-grandmother's brother, who was employed by Western Electric. So they were going along as his guests. So when I was a little girl, you know, we used to love to be with our grandma. We called her Nana, and she was just so fun and so sweet and bubbly, and she just always had so many interesting stories from when she grew up. And so, you know, from the time we were quite young, she told us about this big ship that she was on as a young girl and how she treaded water when she was in between these compartments. And as young girls, when we were listening to her, she, of course, withheld a lot of gory details that she did witness and experience as such a young girl. So, but then as we got older, we learned more and more details when we became adults as to what she experienced. And so, again, I grew up hearing about it. And then when I married Ted, Ted grew up in Elgin. I grew up in Arlington Heights. And Ted had never heard of it until he came into the family. And so he became quite interested as the years went on. And however, we did not form the society until after my grandmother had passed away. But I'll let Ted take it from there as to when we decided to form the society.
Yeah, so sure. So we springboarded off of, you know, Barb's heritage growing up as a young girl. And in 1995, Professor George Hilton wrote the first book about the Eastland disaster. And Barb and I went downtown Chicago, spent a weekend downtown. And as we were downtown, went from store to store, stopped at the library, trying to, you know, locate a copy of this book. We were intending to give it to Barb's mother as a gift. And so as we went store to store, library to library, what we found out when we would ask someone, do you have the new book on the Eastland disaster, we would get that glossed over look, like, oh, sorry, what did you say? And we'd say the Eastland disaster, you know, the ship that rolled over in Chicago. And it was apparent that weekend that people in Chicago didn't know anything about Eastland disaster. They didn't recognize the name. And the more and more people we talked to about it, we experienced the same thing. No one recognized the tragedy. So from there, a couple years passed, and we just finally decided, along with Barb's sister Susan, the three of us decided that it didn't start to do something to change that, that it would probably continue to pass through time and eventually, at best, become a footnote in Chicago's history. So it was actually in 1997, a couple of years later, that we decided we probably should form a not-for-profit. And we organized in 98, started a website with a single web page, and immediately started getting families and descendants contacting us, and they're still contacting us today, 23 years later.
Let's talk about the incident itself, the disaster itself, because I'm thinking the vast majority of people listening right now are like, what is the Eastland disaster? I'll give a couple facts, and then we'll discuss it openly. Saturday, July 24th, 1915, 106 years ago today, it happened. Five ships were chartered to take some 7,000 employees of Western Electric's Hawthorne Works in Cicero. They were Chicago's largest employer at the time. Is this true, Barbara?
Yes. Yes, it is. Ted, you can add even a little bit more to that.
Yes, clearly they were in the Chicago area, the the largest employer at that time.
And they were taking their employees to Michigan City, Indiana for a company picnic. And I think the tickets were, what, 75 cents?
And a dollar, depending on when you bought them. Yes, a dollar and under.
Got it. This ship, can we talk about this ship for a little bit? It's 265 feet long, right?
Yeah.
And there's two masts. The gross tonnage was about what, 1,900 pounds?
Tons.
So this is a big ship.
Sure. It was actually about the length of a football field, your listeners, a visual, and it was roughly 4.5 stories tall, which even for listeners today, it's, I think, for everyone to really visualize the profile of that ship, because we have, 100-foot skyscrapers surrounding the downtown area and the river. But back at that time, the tallest buildings were probably 10 to 15 stories. So a ship that was 4.5 stories tall on the Chicago River was a pretty impressive sight.
Right. And this happened on Clark Street, roughly between Clark and LaSalle, right? On the south shore of the river?
Yeah.
Just trying to paint a picture here. So you've got some 7,000 employees headed downtown on a Saturday morning. It's raining a little bit, right?
Yes, drizzling, sure.
And let's talk about this ship for a little bit before we go into exactly what happened. In 1915, the new Federal Seamen's Act was passed because of the Titanic disaster that happened 3 years earlier.
Correct.
And this was supposed to, the crux of it was to have enough lifeboats on board so a disaster like the Titanic wouldn't happen again, correct?
Exactly. It was known as the Lifeboats for All movement at that time.
Okay. Now, what they did that year, I can't wrap my head around this. Maybe you guys can help me out. They took out the hardwood floors on the cabin level dining room, and they put in 2 inches of concrete, which added about 15 to 20 tons of weight to this ship. Is this correct, Barbara? Why did they do that?
Well, we had heard that they replaced the hardwood because the wood was rotting, and so they had to solidify the walkways and so forth, and they did that with cement, which added to so much more of the top heaviness of the ship. And then again, because they had to add extra lifeboats, that also added to the top heaviness of the ship. And I know that Ted can also discuss more of the construction of the ship from its infancy, if Ted wants to take that.
Oh, sure. So the ship was put into service 12 years prior to 1915. So in 1903, it began its service on the Great Lakes. And it was designed improperly and, as a result, constructed improperly, as it turned out. And through the years, there were numerous modifications, including what you mentioned, Phil, with the concrete replacing the wooden deck, the addition of the lifeboats at the topmost part of the ship. All these modifications aggravated the already poor design. When I say poor design, I'm referring to the inherent stability of the ship. That was where the design and construction failed. And again, through the 12 years leading up to the tragedy, you've got, periodic maintenance, periodic modifications that are made to the ship throughout that 12-year period, and virtually every modification aggravated the instability of the ship.
More with Barb and Ted Wackles of the Eastland Disaster Historical Society. Phil Menicki here at 720 WGN.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore 20 36,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November...
1221. Phil Minicky on 720 WGN. We're talking with Barb and Ted Wackels of the Eastland Disaster Historical Society. The disaster happened 106 years ago on this date, July 24th, 1915. Some numbers. 844 people died, including 290 children. That's more than the Titanic 3 years earlier. 53 children died on the Titanic. 290 children died on the Eastland. Yet, nobody knows about it here in Chicago. Why is that, Ted?
Well, there's lots of ideas that have been offered through the years. The fact that the United States was just entering the conflict over in Europe, World War I, which quickly replaced the front page news. The Eastland disaster was front page for a few days, but then it quickly moved to the back and moved completely out of the news once the United States got more and more involved in World War One. The fact that there wasn't anyone rich or famous on board the Eastland that morning, it was literally first and second generation immigrants, hardworking, salt-of-the-earth people of lots of different ethnicities, mostly from Europe. You're Polish, you're German, you're Czech. So there wasn't anyone of notoriety, no celebrity types that were on board. And so why would anyone care, you know, about them? So there's lots of very plausible ideas that have been circulated through the years. Our opinion, you know, as we sit here 23 years after having organized the not-for-profit, we personally feel that it was just such a horrific, unexpected occurrence of such a significant scope. No one anticipated this. It was a day in the summertime, it was drizzling a little bit, sure, but it was downtown Chicago. The ship was still partially tied to the wharf. This wasn't an accident that happened out on the open seas, on the ocean. There were no icebergs, no torpedoes. It was supposed to be a fantastic festive day, like you mentioned, Phil, for 7,000 people, a 2.5-hour cruise across the southern tip of Lake Michigan, an all-day picnic on Lakefront Michigan City, Indiana, and then return moonlit cruise back to Chicago. So it was all the anticipation had built for this moment. And then in a matter of really about 5 minutes, it went from being the most spectacular day for that year for thousands of people and families. And in a few moments, it became, you know, the worst experience of their lifetime. So we feel that from a collective community, citywide basis, it was almost like the city of Chicago and the surrounding communities, including Cicero, just got thrust into a collective post-traumatic stress disorder type of frame of mind at a community level. So that's what we feel. And if you think back to that time, too, families didn't talk about it like they do today. There wasn't professional counseling available. So families that lost someone, even though they didn't lose someone, went home and pretty much stifled and buried the discussion about it within their families as well as public.
Right. This was the deadliest maritime disaster in Great Lakes history, much more than the Edmund Fitzgerald, which everyone knows about. It was later nicknamed the Blue Collar Titanic because, as Ted, you mentioned, these were blue collar workers. They were hardworking people. And some more numbers, you mentioned families, 22 entire families were destroyed by this. I cannot begin to wrap my head around that, where they didn't know who to notify when they did discover the bodies, and there was no one to notify, because 22 entire families, Barbara, that's insane.
Oh, it is. And you know, all the years that we've been involved in our society, we've come upon so many different families, so many of them who had lost, you know, in, well, some entire families, but there are so many also where the husband died, leaving the wife with five children, or the wife and the baby died, but the, you know, the other little girl survived with the father. And there are so many different stories, which is, it's something that we just cannot even imagine. Like Ted said, you know, they, and I remember my grandma saying too, that, and again, she was a young girl and she woke up in the morning and she was so excited for this big day to go on this big ship. And, you know, to think in a matter of minutes how life can change so quickly. And as Ted mentioned, and this is again through other families who we have spoken to through the years, had said that, you know, whether it was a grandfather or an uncle or whoever it was in the family, said, you know, we're not going to talk about it. We are not going to talk about it, because so many people who have come to us through the years have said just that and have thanked us for having all of this information out there and for making the general public more aware of Chicago's greatest tragedy. And they said that, again, there was so much information that went to the grave with some of the surviving members of this horrible accident. You know, they said, we had no idea of these details. They would never talk about it. And with my grandmother, I don't know if fortunate is the right word to use, but she made us aware of this. And I think it was also just her general personality. She was, even as a young girl, a very vibrant, bubbly girl. And even until her dying day, when she lived to be 90, and in still good health, basically, for an elderly woman, she still was bubbly and vibrant. And so she, in her own personality, she was okay talking about it through the years. Her younger sister, Solveig, who was my grand aunt, had a different personality. She was much more quiet, and she never talked about it. So her sons and grandchildren always said, oh, gosh, Grandma never talked about it. We learned all of this from, you know, from your grandma. And so anyway, my grandma did experience just, it was horrific for her. But boy, I remember when my sister and I were young, she said, this is why it's so important that you know how to swim. And she was a good swimmer, and that did aid in her survival. Although there are, you know, even if you could swim, if people were pulling you under, you had no chance, of course. But she was able to tread water. They were stuck in between decks, and they were in there all day before they were pulled through the portholes to safety. But she did whatever she could. And, you know, well, when we were growing up, we used to vacation in Lake Geneva. And, you know, from the time we were little, she'd be out there in the water with us. And, you know, my father, who was her son, was a fantastic swimmer, too. So she just always instilled that in my sister and I. She, you know, when we were really young, she said, you know, you've got to know how to swim, because that's what helped save me when I was on this ship. And so...
heartbreaking stories. There's no question about that. Again, to reiterate some of the numbers, 844 people died on the Eastland, 290 children, 53 children died on the Titanic. The Edmund Fitzgerald, who we heard the music at the beginning of that segment, 29 crew members died on that ship. We've got more with Barb and Ted Wackels of the Eastland Disaster Historical Society. They do some really, really good work to get the word out of what happened on this very day, 106 years ago. We're going to talk more about some of the pictures that exist, the plaque to mark the disaster, and more. That's after we get an update from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here at 720 WGN. 1237, Phil Menicki on 720 WGN. We're talking with Barb and Ted Wackels of the Eastland Disaster Historical Society. The disaster happened 106 years ago today, July 24th, 1915, when the Eastland was boarded first because it was the largest of five ships that were headed to Michigan City, Indiana, for the Western Electric Company picnic. It was the largest ship, right, Ted?
Actually, that's partially true. That's part of the reason. Probably the bigger reason is that the ships that were chartered the prior year in 1914, the Eastland was one of those ships as well. And in 1914, the Eastland, after it went to Michigan City and made its return, it ran into some difficulty and it was delayed getting back to Chicago. And the Eastland was, at that time, transportation for Chicago and the western coast of Michigan. It ran daily commuter trips between Chicago and Michigan City, between Chicago and St. Joseph, Michigan. And so as it was late returning to Chicago, its regularly scheduled commuter run was delayed because of that. So in 1915, when they signed the contract, the owners of the charter company said, look, the Eastland has got to be the first one out because we don't want it to be delayed again like it was last year. So between the fact that it had one of the largest capacities of the ships that were chartered and the fact that it ran late the prior year were the two reasons that they pushed off first.
Got it. And there was a history of problems included in this ship that I, when I was diving into the information on this, including a mutiny, right?
Right, right, yeah.
Six of the ship's firemen refused to stoke the fire on the Eastland's boiler because they weren't given potatoes for a meal, right?
Right, right, right.
They were arrested at gunpoint, taken to jail, and charged with mutiny. Wow.
Yeah, you don't hear about that these days, so that's a wonderful way to look back at history and try and understand how things were so different then than what they are now.
Sure. And, I mean, the history of this ship, the capacity was increased to 2,500 one week before the disaster. They added more lifeboats and they made it top-heavy, which is, depending who you talk to, one of the main reasons for the disaster as well. And there was litigation. We'll talk about that later. Let's talk a little bit more about the society. You guys got it together because, Barbara, of your, you know, family connection to it. And you said that your grandmother initially didn't give details about what happened, but as you grew older, she opened up more about that, right?
Yes. And I remember, gosh, Ted and I then were already married. Our kids were little, and my grandmother was always interviewed every year through the years. She also became acquaintances and basically, well, I don't know if you'd call it friends, but with Wally Phillips, who used to be on WGN.
The legendary.
Yes. I remember this was probably even back in the 70s it might have started, and she listened to WGN, and he would mention the Eastland disaster, and so that was always kind of neat that he acknowledged it. But then I think he opened up the phone lines and said, you know, if there's anyone who has a connection to it. So my grandmother picked up the phone that one time and called, and they had such a nice conversation on the air. And then, you know, he invited her to call back every year. So she did, and they would talk, and then they wound up meeting downtown at a restaurant with my parents. And he, anyway, so she was also interviewed by some other television stations, newspapers, Chicago Tribune, the Daily Herald, and we would always be at her little apartment here in Arlington Heights when she was interviewed. And I can remember one of those first times where I really saw it in her face when she was getting very detailed. And I remember one of the interviews, I think it was with Janet Davies on ABC, and she said, my grandmother said, I can picture it as if it's today. I can put myself right back there. And so she started talking about more details and things that she saw. And she said what she couldn't get out of her head was the screaming. And I think you hear a lot of people talk about that too. So again, when she would talk about it, she could put herself back there and she could remember it very vividly. And she even said she remembered seeing a man floating by. You know, and it was very gory for her. She went into some details and what she saw. And again, she was 12 years old, almost 13. And
wow.
Anyway, it was really quite interesting. But she was amazing and was always willing to be interviewed. She had no problem with that at all. So we've got some amazing articles in our archives here and pictures with who she was interviewed with. And so.
You mentioned pictures. One of the pictures that it's in my mind right now. I have it in my mind. It was a heavyset gentleman who was a rescuer, and just the look of horror on his face. I think he's holding a child in his arms.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, that is a heart-wrenching picture, and I think everybody who sees that, it's like you can just feel the pain that he must have been feeling. And you think of all of the rescuers who, you know, firemen, policemen, bystanders who witness a tragedy like this, and you can relate it to any kind of tragedy, and you think of the PTSD that they must suffer from after things like this that they live with. And but yes, that's just it's a very gut-wrenching picture.
Yeah, absolutely. More pictures you can find on your website, right? The Eastland Disaster Historical Society. There's a bunch of great information there. A couple more questions about the society. You guys gather every year at the site, correct? Is this true, Ted?
Yes, we've been doing this since the year 2000, and we get together only for a few moments to commemorate and remember what happened, like you said, 106 years ago this year. And it's part memorial. It's also largely commemorating all of the people that were involved and affected by the tragedy. It's not just the victims that suffered PTSD and went through a very heart-wrenching experience. The survivors, many of whom lost one or more members, co-workers at Western Electric, lost neighbors, lost members of their congregation. So it's sometimes easy to gravitate to and focus on the 844, and that's clearly a huge part of what we do every year. But we also need to remember those that survived, the families that were back in Cicero and Chicago while their loved ones were going on the picnic, all the rescuers, heroes really for hours and days afterwards that came to the rescue, had nothing maybe to do with the picnic or with anyone that was attending, but put their lives on the line in an attempt to try and help those that needed it. So we go down to the exact location where the Eastland rolled over between Clark and LaSalle on the south bank of the Chicago River, and we hold a brief memorial commemoration ceremony. And then we conclude it by, typically we, in the past, we've had the Coast Guard assist us. The past few years, we've chosen to have several dozen roses, have the petals picked off of the flowers, and those people that have gathered for the ceremony grab a handful of rose petals, and we have a moment of silence when they drop the petals into the river, remembering those who lost their lives, those who, you know, were part of the tragedy in one way or another, and that's how we recognize it every year.
And there's a plaque there to this day. Is this true? I know there were problems with it, that it was stolen. Is it still there? I know the Riverwalk is very vibrant nowadays, and things are very, very different from back then. There is a plaque, right, though, right?
Right, right, right. Yes, the original plaque was dedicated, I believe it was 1989. It was started by a school out in Aurora, the Illinois Mathematics and Science Academy. Their class at that time heard about the Eastland disaster. They could not believe that there wasn't any memorial of any kind, plaque-wise, downtown Chicago to acknowledge at least what had happened. And so they worked together with a couple of their teachers and dedicated the original marker, which was up on Upper Wacker, about halfway in between Clark and LaSalle. And then in 2000, when Wacker Drive was being rebuilt, we don't know if it was stolen, if it was removed to be while they were painting and refurbishing that area as part of the Wacker Drive reconstruction. We're not sure exactly what happened to it, but it did disappear. And we tried to locate it. We couldn't, and we wound up raising the funds and working with the Illinois State Historical Society to forge a new replacement marker that's exactly the same, the same text as what was there previously, and we rededicated that, I believe it was 2003, and that marker is now located at the corner of LaSalle and Wacker when you stand the site where the Easton was docked that morning.
Some interesting things brought up there in that segment. Something about PTSD, that really didn't exist then, but can you just imagine being involved in this disaster? Wally Phillips also mentioned here on WGN some good memories there. More with Barb and Ted Wackels of the Eastland Disaster Historical Society. Phil Menicki here at 720 WGN. Phil Menicki on 720 WGN. We're talking with Barb and Ted Wackels of the Eastland Disaster Historical Society. The disaster happened 106 years ago on this date, July 24th, 1915. It is the largest loss of life event in Chicago history. Some 300, that's an estimate, died in the Chicago fire on October 8th, 1871. 844 people, including 290 children, 22 entire families were lost in the Eastland disaster. Kind of an important person was almost on the ship. He was late. Didn't make the boat. 20-year-old George Hallis. He worked at Western Electric as a summer job while at the University of Illinois. But he got there late and was not on the boat.
That's right.
Of course, you always think about what could have happened if he had been on, if he was one of the fatalities, what the Chicago Bears, and for that matter, the National Football League would look like today, or if they would even, either of those would exist. We just don't know because he was such a huge instrumental part of that. But you know, that just highlights the whole concept of fate and how his life was clearly spared. He did have a ticket. That's documented. His name is in the newspapers at that time as being one of the missing.
And the story goes that some fraternity brothers visited his home to send their condolences, and he was there saying, "What are you guys doing here?" Something like that.
Yes.
And that's a great way to move away from the devastation and the loss aspect of the tragedy and move to the lighter side and the fate, how something as trivial, as minor, as insignificant as being a few minutes late to arrive downtown clearly impacted his life, his family through the years, through the generations, and even more publicly, you know, the Chicago Bears and the National Football League.
Sure. Let's wrap things up here. Ted and Barbara Wackels of the Eastland Disaster Historical Society. There's only like a minute and 30 seconds of newsreel film footage that was discovered on the 100th anniversary. How did that come about?
Yeah, that's just one of those amazing stories. And you have to, of course, ask, how is it that it went all those years? And then secondly, how is it that it was the centennial anniversary that it surfaced? So it was a grad student, his name is Jeff Nichols, just an awesome guy. He's a Chicagoan. He's a hardcore researcher. And he had been doing some research for his PhD work. And as he was viewing some film footage on a film archive site or in Europe, he's watching footage of World War One, which is what his PhD work was about. And in the middle of I think it was about a 15-minute clip on World War One, here was just this little slice of actual live motion footage from shortly after the Eastman rolled over. And of course, Jeff being the diehard Chicago guy that he is, he immediately recognized it. You know, the film footage wasn't labeled Eastman Disaster. It wasn't labeled Chicago. It had no identifying marks or text. He just knew it for what it was, which was the Eastman Disaster. So he contacted us, and that just really, I'd say, blew the lid off of the plans for the centennial commemoration that we had, because that was the first ever seen film footage from the tragedy.
Well, we're glad that he found it. Ted and Barbara Wackels of the Eastland Disaster Historical Society, thank you for spending some time with us. Where do people go to learn more about what happened? Barbara?
You can go to our website, which is eastlanddisaster.org. And, you know, we have just a ton of information there. And if anyone has any connection, any affiliation with Eastland, please contact us. We would love to hear your story.
And what a story it is. Wow. 106 years ago today, the Eastland disaster. The Riverwalk ceremony, by the way, is open to the public. It will be held at the site of the Eastland disaster along the Chicago Riverwalk, just west of the Clark Street Bridge. And that starts at noon today.